I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
All right, welcome along to this very special podcast. Now, you're saying to yourself, Niall, you normally only do Monday to Thursday, and you kind of only do, you know, 12 o'clock in the daytime when we're all just getting our brains into cycle mode. Well, I decided to do something different because a good friend of mine, God love her, you know, she's kind of used to doing a podcast, and then all of a sudden it just stopped. And it's like, do you know when you see a dog in a kennel that's lost its owner and you feel pity for it? And you just want to bring it along and take it and give it a bit of a hug and a squeeze and let it bite you if it wants to bite you every now and again. Or you see a little orphan in an orphanage that just needs love and a home, somewhere it can give out. Well, I decided to do that with Sarah Ryan, who's normally with John McGurk, by the way. But she's decided to invest herself a little bit in me today. And Sarah Ryan, thank you very much indeed for joining me. I should hire you up, really, shouldn't I? That'd be a good idea, rather than keeping you quiet for the whole show. Sorry, Sarah, did you say something?
I think that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Well, I thought you were like a little lost dog that needed a hug. Oh, okay. Anyway, Sarah, obviously, you know, yourself and John do the podcast on a regular basis. You kind of miss it, I suppose. You miss that little outlet, you know, to vent your anger or whatever it happens to be. And people probably want to know, what's the story? When are you and John going to start battling again?
The answer to that is I don't know. But the answer is that we will be back at some point, hopefully soon. Just need a few things sorted out, but the plan is to come back for sure.
Yeah, I know, because look, we all know the story has been in the news. Mind you, it's probably the one time that RT have actually acknowledged John exists. But they ran the story that was in Grip Media, of course, during the week in relation to John's situation currently at the moment. Anyway, look, I look forward to having you both back again. But in the meantime, I don't look like John. I probably don't sound like him, and I surely don't have all the same opinions as him, because I should be wearing my MAGA hat. Actually, I do have my Donald Trump here. Bet you John hasn't got one of them. Anyway, let's look at some of the big stories. Now, we couldn't not start with Bertie Ahern. Yes, Bertie. We couldn't not start with Bertie Ahern. So there was Bertie going around doing a bit of canvassing, helping his Fianna Fáil running mates out. And he's sidetracked at a door and somebody is secretly recording him. And he just spills the beans. I mean, you just couldn't make up the stuff that he said. Now, just to clarify what he actually said. He said there was too many Africans coming into Ireland, specifically mentioning Africans, by the way, from the Congo. And he said the next generation of Muslims growing up in Ireland, he said they're the ones to look out for, the next generation of Muslims. Not this one, but the next generation. Do you think he really meant that? He's saying now, Sarah, he was taken out of context. I can't see how he was taken out of context. Not that I disagree with some of the stuff he said, by the way.
I don't see how he's taken out of context. I mean, it's a recording. He's probably a bit bewildered. I'm sure he didn't know he was being recorded, and he's probably a bit bewildered by the response to it from the chattering media classes, we'll call them. But I think over the next week or so, he'll probably, as this story plays out, he'll probably be quite taken aback about the amount of people who agree with him. And I think that a lot of people do agree with him. And I think a lot of people in Fianna Fáil agree with him, because I know some of them. And I think that there is the public message is, oh, Bertie Ahern should withdraw that, and isn't that a terrible thing to say? But WhatsApp groups that I'm in with Fianna Fáil people are alive with
good. Somebody had to say it.
They totally agree with that.
Yeah, somebody just had to say it. Yeah, at some point. Now, he might have went a bit over the top, but it is surprising that a person who's been in politics all his life would say something off camera that they didn't want going public. Because, you know, even when we were doing the election that time, you have to be careful. If somebody even goes up on the street and says something to you, you kind of have to be careful just in case they're recording you, just in case somebody catches it or hears it or reports it to a newspaper or whatever. So it is kind of surprising that he was caught off camera, isn't it?
Is it, or is it that he had a mind that he might run for president, that didn't work out, and now he's simply being honest, doesn't really care as much, or not that he doesn't care, but just isn't afraid anymore of putting this face forward that all other politicians have to. They have to play this game. They don't want to say the thing that gets you into trouble. They're afraid of their life of saying something that will, you know, upset one of the NGOs or one of the right people in Ireland. So they keep quiet. They'll privately say to you or me, oh, I agree with this or I don't agree with that, but they will never say it publicly. And maybe once Bertie realised he wasn't going to be president, he just started being more honest.
But why couldn't he be honest when he was the Taoiseach of the country? Well, now, don't get me wrong. I have to say, even though I know people don't like, some people don't like Bertie, you know, after the whole, you know, I don't have a bank account and all that kind of carry on, even though he was Minister for Finance, which is really odd. But in saying that, I always thought he was a kind of bit of a man of the people. I mean, much more than any politician is now. I remember there was a flood down near Drumcondra in the middle of the winter, and there was like 4 foot of water where the wall had broken and it burst its banks or something like that. And sure, Bertie was there at 2 o'clock in the morning in his wellies, you know, knee deep in the water for the photograph for the Irish Independent the next morning. So he kind of was down with the people a bit, wasn't he?
Oh, for sure. And he was a politician of his time and people kind of had a soft spot for him. And he was, you know, there's always this test in politics, in American politics, of who's the guy you want to have a beer with. You know, with all due respect to anybody listening to this who doesn't really like Bertie, would you rather go for a pint with Micheál Martin or Leo Varadkar or Simon Harris or Bertie?
Oh, Bertie, without a doubt. Actually, I got a picture of me and Bertie during the election campaign. I was advised not to put it up online at the time because it may not have done my election campaign any good. But the irony of the picture was we just happened to be standing in front of a huge big poster which said "Bank It," which was quite ironic considering the man allegedly never had a bank account at all the time when he was in office. I mean, I think he was just saying probably what a lot of people are thinking. But of course, the left have come out and said, oh, this is divisive language. And then you've Umar al-Qadri coming out and saying, this is not right. The poor old Muslims, you can't be talking about them like that. So is it divisive language?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's divisive language in circumstances where you're speaking, you think privately to one person. Mm. This is a person who brought this up to him. This isn't a press release that he released. He didn't say it on TV. He said it. He didn't realize he's being recorded. So that's the first thing. He's speaking to somebody on a doorstep about an issue that they've brought up. But I don't think I only speak for myself when I say the accusations of divisive language and all of these things are just red herrings that are thrown into the debate all the time to avoid having a conversation about the substance of what he's saying. And the substance of what he's saying is that there is a huge cohort of people in Ireland at the moment who think that immigration is too high and it's causing social unrest and social problems, particularly when it comes to resources in disadvantaged areas. And anytime anybody goes beyond what you're allowed to say or says something like this, the entire focus becomes on whether it's divisive language or whether you should say it, because that's the best space to hide to avoid having a conversation about whether what he's saying is true.
Mm. But according to the politicians running in the Central Dublin elections, when they were on Virgin Media or TV3, as people know it still, because it was the worst rebranding ever in history, they said nobody's mentioning immigration in the doorsteps, which I find very difficult to believe. Nobody is mentioning immigration. I mean, really? Nobody? Should they say that during the EU elections? Sure, we were going to the doorsteps. We were in the shopping centres and everybody was mentioning immigration. But yet, seemingly, to these people, nobody's... Maybe they're not mentioning to them because they know they're not going to do anything about it, so there's no point in saying it to them. Or maybe it's just because they're going to the doorsteps of fellow lefties who don't care, really.
But also, you know, if you're so... publicly, like, for example, the Social Democrats, if you're so publicly against any conversation about immigration, even if you are concerned about it, are you really going to bring it up?
But yeah, you're not going to bring it up. But even at the doorstep, if they do bring it up, they probably just pawn it off very quickly and say, oh, have you got enough money for your heat? I'll miss this. Anyway, moving on from Bertie Ahern, and another divisive topic, I suppose, because I talked about this on RTÉ 2 weeks ago when I was ambushed by Alison O'Connor. I get onto that again. But this is in relation to Ukrainians. So there's two stories here. So Jim O'Callaghan said, firstly, we can't keep paying out all this money and all these supports. You know, we have to pull back on this. The lefties went mad. And now he's added even more fuel to the fire by suggesting, now he hasn't made his mind up yet, that we're going to give them a bit of a payment if they want to go home. And the very idea that somebody would want to go home it to take a payment, be it an asylum seeker to Africa or be it a Ukrainian to Ukraine, well, it kind of proves the place wasn't too bad in the first place, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it negates the principle of their being here.
Yeah.
Because surely if you're an asylum seeker under the law, you don't return home because of fear of persecution, fear of death, or, you know, a number of other things. So there wouldn't be an amount of money that would be able to pay you to go back.
I was thinking, I was thinking of learning Ukrainian maybe and then posing as a Ukrainian to get the money. Do you think it would work?
I mean, listen, there are worse uses of your time now. Yeah.
And the other thing as well that pisses me off, I just got to get this out here, right? It pisses me off. I seen the other day Ukrainian registration on an X5 BMW. No harm to them. Everybody's entitled to earn money. Everybody's entitled to do well in life, okay? But obviously this car was purchased in Ukraine. And they, I don't know how long they're here, 2, 3, 4 years, I don't know. But they're still on Ukrainian plates, still obviously not paying any car tax, still don't have an NCT. And this whole idea that we kind of just let them away with it 4 years later, it's a bit bonkers, isn't it?
I mean, I think that the money on pets and stuff was really the moment.
5 million.
I just think, I think people in Ireland are very welcoming, and I think everybody was on board with, you know, there was a war and people absolutely 100% on board with that. But I think paying people to go back, you're either the war is, either it's safe to go back or it's not. Like, it's as simple as that.
But it's a huge country, the size of France. I mean, and there's only, you know, part of it. I mean, a couple of regions, which are obviously dangerous. Now, I know air raids go off, and John McGurk was telling me that last week when he was there in Kyiv, I think, you know, there was, you know, the air raids go off every now and again, but unlikely that anything would actually happen. That's like saying we were terrified in Dublin because there was a war in Northern Ireland. We weren't really. You know, there was one bomb, I think, went off, or two bombs went off in Dublin. And that was about it. I mean, I don't think people were terrified generally. We didn't all leave the country.
John was there 2 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things have certainly improved to a large extent since then. But I think it's not what I find interesting about it is not the principle of whether or not it's safe to go back. Is that the government seems to be intent. There's always a gimmick. There's always some kind of angle. There's always, you know, Roderick O'Gorman tweeting out in multiple languages, whatever, because I don't understand why if when it's safe to go back, it's safe to go back. It either is or it isn't. There shouldn't be a payment to do it. It either is or isn't. When we wanted people to come here, they're welcome to come here. If they qualify under the law to stay, great. You don't need to tweet it out in 10 languages. There's always some kind of gimmick. Some NGO has come up with some great idea and none of it ever works. It just annoys people. If you're a person who's struggling to feed their family, struggling to pay childcare costs, struggling to pay, you know, all of the cost of living that happens in Ireland right now, you're just aggravated by this kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a family who's a couple who are in their 60s or whatever, and their three children have emigrated to America, Australia, and somewhere else, why do you feel if you feel that people are being given a payment to leave? Your kids didn't get a payment to leave.
That's what Pat O'Tobin was talking about too. And you know, he'll probably get accused of all sorts of divisive things by suggesting this, that Irish people shouldn't get less than people from other countries. In other words, just because you're from another country, you shouldn't get a support that Irish people are not entitled to. In other words, the 400 quid, of course, you know, the rental accommodation payment that they get. And not on top of that as well, they get other supports too that Irish people don't get. Now, that was all well and good for the settling in period, probably for 6 months. But here we are 4 years later, and there's still a massively high unemployment rate. You know, so integration doesn't seem to be working too well for many of them. Not all of them. Some of them, I'm sure, are working very hard. But, like, really more of them need to get a job. So it is kind of time to say you have to paddle your own boat, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think... perhaps the settling in period, fine, but what would be the argument for somebody making more money than an Irish person who's unemployed? If housing is covered and other things are covered, we're all living in Ireland. We're all paying, you know.
Well, I knew somebody at the time when the war broke out, well, just a couple of months after the war broke out, and he was Ukrainian, but he was living in London and working for a tech company and working remotely, an American tech company. He was working remotely. And he moved from London to Ireland because he could get the 800 quid rent and accommodation payment and the other supports that were available and still work away remotely because it wasn't means tested. And he's well paid, by the way, but it wasn't means tested. So he moved from London to Ireland just so he could get the payments and the benefits. It was completely abused by so many people.
That's outrageous.
And then not only that, you had a lot of people coming into the country who weren't really Ukrainians. Let's be clear about it. You know, and you say, well, I'm sorry, but you look Pakistani or African. You're not Ukrainian. And you go, oh, yeah, but I was studying in Ukraine when the war broke out. Really? So they were kind of flying into the Ukraine just before the war broke out or just as the war broke out. And then making their way back out of it again. I mean, the whole system seemed to be abused. We seem to be good at that, by the way. People taking advantage of our kindness on a regular basis. Yeah. Unisex toilets. Harold's Cross. The Educate Together School. It was all over most of the media, but not the mainstream media. I don't think RTE gave it a mention. And some people would say, this isn't such a big deal, and it's a kind of storm in a teacup. And so the plans went in for two, into Dublin City Council, for two toilets, male and female. But somewhere in the middle, somebody decided to change the plans, took down the wall and just put a few sinks in the middle and put male and female signs on all the doors. Is it, I mean, it's teenagers, it's secondary school. Is it a big deal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely it is. I mean, I talk about this topic all the time on my podcast. It's an issue that's particularly close to my heart. I don't think that there should be gender neutral toilets. I don't think there should be men and women in sports. I don't think there should be men and women's prisons. Just because a woke ideology has taken hold of the country by the throat doesn't change that fact.
Well, no, that should be your transphobia. That's the thing to say to you, just for using the word ideology.
I think a lot of the transgender debate is littered with misogyny. I think it's anti-women. So if I'm a transphobe, other
people. So be it. You'll take it. Yeah. I know. I've been called a transphobe loads of times.
I don't think that men should be in women's prisons, and I don't think men should be in women's toilets, and I don't think there should be unisex. There is lots and lots and lots of vulnerable women out there. Most women who go to prison are vulnerable. You know, women who are in bathrooms on their own are vulnerable. Men are more physically strong, and most women, I think, if you speak to them privately, will say that they would prefer their own toilets. And just because they're afraid to say it publicly, that's a different thing. But somewhere along the line, somebody got a hold of this and made it into a gender neutral toilet. I don't think it's a small thing. I think it's a pattern that women have to make sacrifices. Women's safety and
but your men are making sacrifices too. Because there was a woman on the air to me during the week, and she was saying that she was in this situation in the UK, and when she was living there, because they had a unisex toilet at the school, and her son purposely didn't go to the toilet in the school. He used to go around to the back of the school to where the bike sheds were or whatever and have a pee in a bush because he didn't want to put girls in an awkward position. That was very thoughtful of him. But so what I'm saying to you is that I agree with you, by the way. There should be no unisex toilets. Girls deserve their privacy and dignity, particularly the fact that they have periods and that's a very private thing and they want to put their makeup on or whatever it happens to be that men really, you know, shouldn't be getting involved in. But the whole argument kind of makes men out to be, leaving aside the trans issue and the trans part, and the real reason why they did this was to obviously pander to gender ideology, right? But there is an argument being made by some people online, and you know, that kind of men are dangerous, or you know, women can't be in the same place as men because men are monsters, or you know, we're like, most of us are not. Like, if I went into the Jacks and you were in there, I'm not going to go and see, can I look under the stall to have a look at you, or something like that, or you know, or see, can I watch you to see what you're up to? Like, most men couldn't give a damn, they just want to go and have a pee.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that most men is one thing, but there are men who take advantage of this situation, and those men, women need to be protected from those men. I mean, like you shouldn't have a situation where a woman, particularly a young female, is concerned about a man in the toilet with her. And I take your point that it's not all men, but at the end of the day, Niall, the studies have been done on prisons, particularly in the UK and the US, and they say that transgender women who are in women's prisons are 4 times more likely to be sex offenders than the average male prisoner. That's not my opinion. That's facts.
No. I'm well aware of that, but we have to remember there is a very small amount of transgender men who are in women's prisons. Yeah.
Not all men and all that, but at the same time, this all comes about from a situation where we're trying to protect, we're taking rights and taking privacies away from women to protect men's feelings, and I'm just against it.
Yeah, but men kind of get a bad rap, don't they? This whole kind of toxic masculinity thing, and, you know, we're all mad and we're all just sex starved and we're all running around looking for the next woman, you know, to have it off with. I mean, we're not like that. Generally speaking, we're not. Or somebody said to me on the air one day, all men are potential paedophiles. When we were talking about, you know what she was arguing about? There was a listener had come on and said she had dropped her kid off at the local creche and realised there was a new member of staff, it was a man. She gave out to the boss because she said, I'm not leaving my kid and my daughter in a creche where there's a man working. You know, you need to get rid of him. And some of the other parents all got together and said, we don't want a man working in the creche. Like all, and her argument was to me that all men, maybe all men are not paedophiles, but they're all potential paedophiles. I go, well, where did you get that from? Like, they're not. Yeah, but,
well, all people are potential everything, but like...
No, we're not.
I'm the most pro... All people are potential everything, Niall. Like, anybody could be anything, but like, all men aren't potential paedophiles. Like, I'm the most... On our podcast in the last couple of years, I've been the most... One of the most vocal things I've been about this, like, complete dehumanization of young men and young boys. All men are this. Adolescence was a TV show that was designed specifically to incite terror, that all men were being corrupted on the internet by Andrew Tate and they were all going to be horrible, horrible people. I totally agree with you that all men aren't anything, but I think that they're completely different things. I think young white males are completely demonized in the media and they have to have all the rapiness and the horribleness trained out of them by their mothers. I absolutely refute that and think it's one of the scourges of modern society, frankly. But I don't think that that's the same as this issue. I think this issue is a completely different thing. And I think that women are entitled to spaces that are free of men. And I think, but I think that men aren't intrinsically bad either. I think they're different.
But they're not going to change this. There's been no statement further in relation to this particular story, apart from the school blames the Department of Education and their guidelines. And the Department of Education is blaming the school, saying it's up to the school to put in their own sanitary, you know, utility rooms or whatever it happens to be. So they're all blaming each other and nobody's taking responsibility. And yet nobody seems to know how the plans change, because the original plans that went into Dublin City Council were for 2 toilets. So somebody in the middle, probably a purple-haired person, changed the plans, and nobody seems to know who.
But isn't that Ireland, Niall? I mean, we still don't know who signed off on the bike shed that was, you know, however many euro. This we're absolutely inundated with cowardice. Nobody will ever admit who did that or when that decision was made, because they don't want the public ire. But they got their way. They got boys into the girls' toilets. It's not going to change, as they say.
But nobody ever gets fired. That's what pisses me off. Nobody ever, like the Children's Hospital, for example, you know, billions over budget and, you know, and time as well. 2016, they put the plans in for this hospital. Here we are 10 years later, and it probably won't be open to the general public for at least another year and a half, I would imagine. And even then, it won't be running properly for about 3 or 4 years till they get all the staff up and running and trained and all that kind of carry on, right? And yet, I mentioned the other day, there's a new theme park in Florida, which is like 10 times bigger, has like 4 hotels, 10 restaurants, you know, God knows how many roller coasters and all that kind of thing. It's like a city, and they built it in 2 years. And I said, we can't even build a hospital, you know, in 10 years, a hospital. And nobody, the same with the jacks, the same with the bike sheds, the same with everything else, nobody gets fired. Nobody ever gets fired. They just get moved on.
And the hospital has 300 parking spaces for 3,000 or 2,000 staff. That would be somebody, I guarantee you, in there, somebody with somebody's ideology, which was, we shouldn't be driving,
oh, yeah,
you should be getting. So that's where that came from. Nobody will get the blame for that. Is somebody supposed to put their child who's got a temperature of 104 onto the Lewis?
Who decided, by the way, that was a good place for a national hospital? I mean, why not out on the outskirts of the M50, make it more accessible to people outside Dublin as well? I mean, somewhere which is accessible, loads of green fields, you could put massive car parks in, just an exit ramp down onto it. Who decided to put it? Let's put it in the most awkward place to get to, possibly in the middle of the city. I mean, who signed that off? Is there people in that building? What's the civic office, which is there along the quays? You know, that building that was murdered over years ago in Wood Quay. It's called the civic office, where they design all the planning and everything else. Is there, like, down in the basement, is there a group of people with, like, pin the tail on the donkey? Is that the way it works in Dublin?
And I know, because I remember that there was real push to put it on a site up around Blanchardstown Hospital. Mm-hmm. And that there was, and if you're, you know, the thing as well is that this assumption that you might, if your child gets sick, bring them on the Lewis, but also that your child will not get sick during the peak traffic times. You're trying to get into town. What if your child developed symptoms of meningitis at 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
Mm-hmm.
Are you just going to sit in traffic? Because we know that the ambulance probably isn't coming for you.
And if you're coming from Port Leash or Kildare or Maynooth, that side of the city, which is the worst traffic ever, it could take you 2 or 3 hours just to get in, just to get to a hospital, which is only 20 miles away. I mean, it's ridiculous. Okay, let's move on from that. Something this is probably going to affect your life more than anybody else's, Sarah's. And I'm really sad to have to tell you that Michael O'Leary wants to ban alcohol from airports. Now, I went a step further during the week and I asked our listeners, should we just ban it from planes altogether? Because there's nothing worse than getting on a plane with a load of yokes going down to Ibiza or Canaries or whatever it is. And they're all singing and talking about sex and throwing up. And it's just, why? Like, it's like the party starts in the taxi on the way to the airport. I mean, do you think it should be just banned? Now, O'Leary, by the way, is a cuter. Because he's saying ban it in the airports. He's still going to serve it on his planes and make a fortune out of it. But ban it in the airports so they're not too drunk getting on the plane in the first place. But should we just ban it completely?
No. I mean...
Why do you want to drink, Sarah?
I don't. I mean, if I'm on, I go to Greece, as you know, in the summer. I never drink on the flight. But if I was going away for a weekend with the girls, I might have a drink, but I don't make a show of myself. I mean, why should you or I not be able to have a vodka and coke on a flight, Niall, just because other people can't behave themselves?
Well, I wouldn't be having a vodka and coke because I don't drink, but I'd have the coke, well, you know, but not the vodka.
The Red Bull.
But here's the thing. Yeah. I was on a flight. It was a transatlantic flight and there was myself and there was Karen and then this lad, right, was sitting beside us and his wife was on the other aisle seat and he was milling back the drink and then he produces like a bottle he bought a duty free out of his bag and starts pouring that as well. Out then comes the bag and he starts vomiting into the bag. Then he's putting his head up over his shoulder and I was like, oh my God, like I just can't be dealing with this. Like the sound, because when I hear somebody getting sick, I feel like, you know, when you hear it, you just feel like getting, see, I'm even thinking about it now, I'm gagging. You just feel like getting sick. And it's just, why? And that was his holiday began when he got on the plane.
I mean, like, that's an extreme.
But they were still serving him.
Yeah, well, they didn't obviously know that he had a bottle in a bag underneath the chair, Niall.
And a bag of vomit as well under the chair. And by the time the flight finished, by the way, his wife wasn't talking to him. And it was funny, we kind of followed them out, you know, through the walkway. And his wife went about 200 yards in front of him and off she went. And he was like 200 yards behind her, struggling to keep up with her. She just wasn't talking to him. That was that holiday ruined. But I don't understand why people just ban it. I mean, I understand that you're not going to do it to the extreme, although I haven't witnessed that. I'm, you know, maybe you have at some point in your life. But in saying that, why take the risk? That's all right on a train or a bus, because you can stop the bus. And if Sarah's had too much, we can chuck her off. Or stop the train at the next station, we can chuck her off. You know, but on a plane, we can't chuck you off it. Oh, good, I suppose.
Because people are adults and... People,
but they're not behaving like adults, are they, some of them?
Well, most do. Most do. I mean, I've been on many, many flights and I've yet to see someone vomiting.
That's because you're in the first class area. You don't see that.
Ryanair doesn't have a first class. You know, like, I mean, people are adults. It's kind of like saying, well, if, you know, people are eating too much so we won't have any food. Like,
that's not the same thing at all. That's not even a good analogy.
If they get really fat, Like what you're getting into is a libertarian type of, or an anti-libertarian thing, whereas I'm more libertarian, which is basically, I think adults should be allowed to do whatever they want, and as long as it's not causing any harm to someone else. I take your point that you don't like the sound of somebody vomiting, fair enough, but I think for the most part, people don't do that. And I think that it's this authoritarian thing that comes in Ireland all the time, which is that, like, let's ban this and you shouldn't be allowed to have that. And you should, you know, we'll tax this and we're adults.
And it's not just the vomiting or the sound of the vomiting. I was going to the Canaries going back a good few years ago. And my stepdaughter was with us and she was only about 10, 11 at the time. And there was like a group of girls in front of us and a group of lads, like in their 20s, behind us. And they were all drinking, obviously. Then they started singing. Then the girls were shouting back at the lads, "Me is in the pub tonight. You never know what will happen. You fucker lad." And I'm going, oh. I mean, stepdaughter has to listen to all this. She's only 10. Like, that's just not good behavior. People behave badly with alcohol on them. That's why I don't drink, by the way. Because they behave badly with alcohol on them. They don't care. Inhibitions go out the door. They'll practically strip off in front of you. And they don't care.
Niall, you're turning into a granddad. Honestly. Like,
people know I'm anti-drink. I'm not a drinker, so I don't have time for drinkers.
Those people could have been leery and talking about riding each other if they were sober.
But when you've got kids on a flight, like on a family holidays, and people are talking about riding and all sorts of things. And then there was another time I was actually going to, I was in the UK, I can't remember what I was going over for, and it was a group of football supporters, Newcastle supporters, I think they were, if I remember rightly. And they were all going over, somebody was playing Newcastle, it must have been an Irish team, I know nothing about football. And one of the staff, cabin crew, was walking past, and your man slaps her on the arse. Now, she just kind of laughed it off. You know, now, don't get me wrong. I'm not one of these people who believes that somebody should be arrested in jail for life or something like that. He shouldn't do it. It's a horrible thing to do, right? To invade somebody else's space. But like, he wouldn't have done that if he wasn't pissed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's not that I'm saying that he should be allowed to behave like that. It's that I'm saying that everybody on the flight shouldn't have their right to have a drink limited because of him.
Will you? I can't smoke on a plane, can I? And smoking has never made me slap somebody on the arse, vomit, or act like a fool. And yet they banned that.
But smoking would be leaking across the entire flight and everyone would be having to inhale it in.
All right, let's not continue any harm. That's a myth.
I think there's been studies. I think someone
No, I'm talking... I'm not talking about... Of course, if you smoke, it's not good for you. I'm well aware of that, right? But I'm talking about passive smoking. There's been loads of studies in relation to passive smoking that it's not a bit of a myth. You know what I mean? Unless you're blowing it into your face or something like that. So there was only a few of us down the back of the plane having a quick smoke. Do you remember the seats down the back you could have a smoke? Do you remember that?
And the ashtray. In the hand of the thing, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember? I mean, you're younger than me. Do you remember when you could smoke on a plane?
Yeah, I think I just about do. Just about.
Mm.
But if you think about it now, it's disgusting.
When I think back, actually, when I remember when smoking, I remember when everybody smoked on the buses. And that was when the buses had no back door. Do you remember that? You could just jump on. And then they banned the smoking downstairs. So you had to go upstairs to smoke. And then they banned it upstairs apart from the back seats. It was kind of slowly just moving us out of the bus.
Working you all.
Anyway, now let's get to something more serious. RTE, which could never really be taken seriously anymore, to be honest with you. Okay, so this boycott. Now, let me be clear about this. I don't watch the Eurovision. I stopped watching it years ago when I was a kid. It was a family entertainment thing years ago. Now it's just this kind of flamboyant nonsense, right? But either way, it's one of the most popular televisual feasts, as John Cleese would say. You know, next to the Olympic Games, next to the World Cup, it's one of the biggest audiences in Europe for television. So RTE make the brave decision. Kevin Backhurst decides, who was put in there, by the way, to fix RTE with taxpayers' money, that we're not going to take an impartial view of this. We're actually going to take action because we're listening to our staff and our staff are telling us we need to make a stand against Israel. So not only are we not going to put an entry in, but we're actually not even going to show it. So now we're going to send people to the BBC on Saturday night to watch it. Was it the right decision?
I think it's the wrong decision. I think it's a huge event for some people. I don't think it anybody cared. Like I'm like you. I used to love the Eurovision when I was younger. You know the way you'd kind of watch it, that we only had two
for
channels.
Ireland. Yeah.
Yeah, it was on. And sometimes we used to win and it was kind of fun. And I'm long since stopped watching it, especially in the last few years. And this kind of like just, it's like woke on steroids. Every year it's getting worse. But
it all started with the lad with the beard and the dress. What was his name? Remember him? Or was it a him? I don't know if it was a him. I think he claimed to be a her, but it had a beard. Was
oh yeah, not from Ireland, from another country.
From another country, yeah. No, it wasn't. It
yeah,
wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. No, we had Bambi.
Oh, the witch.
Yeah, so she was a witch who was queer, but she was with a man. I can't forget it.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I didn't even know it was on, to be honest. I was talking to John McGurk today, and I said it kind of fell off my radar. And I think it's performative nonsense, and it will make no difference to anything. And
virtue signaling, just virtue signaling. Yeah. But the problem is, and we've seen on numerous occasions, the staff of RTE protesting over. Well, I remember there was a protest last year over journalists in Gaza, and you know they kind of keep protesting all the time in relation to that. I mean. Are RTE wrong to take a position? Because it is a position. You are taking a political position, aren't you? I'm not denying this horrible stuff happening, by the way. You know, I know there's people dying, you know, and there's people being killed and murdered and all that kind of thing. So I'm not denying this horrible thing's happening, but taking a political position, do you think it's wrong?
Yeah, I do, because they're the state broadcaster and they shouldn't. Because that's the way the state broadcaster should be, neutral. And I know there's people who will say there's a genocide happening or whatever, but there is things happening all over the world. And if RTE becomes a political wing of a lefty kind of movement within its ranks, it doesn't serve the public well. And people are paying a TV license for balanced, unbiased broadcasting. So I just don't think, I think the precedent being set that they're a politically active in that way is wrong.
And they've also now pissed off Graham Linehan as well, who now has he's put up one of those kind of protest sites where he wants people to sign up because they're showing Father Ted instead. Now, I think they probably did it on purpose to piss him off, to be honest with you. So this is the Father Ted Eurovision episode, and he says he doesn't want what he co-founded, or co-wrote, should I say, being used as part of a political football.
Ironic. Hmm. Because he is quite pro-Israel, as far as I am aware.
Yeah.
And is against the mainstream on all of the transgender and pretty much everything RTE stands for. So it's funny the way they'll accept Graham Linehan's work and use Graham Linehan's work as a political football, but they won't have him on The Late Late Show when he was arrested for... basically in contravention of his freedom of speech in London when he was boarding a flight. They didn't report on, they didn't have him on The Late Late Show. If he'd been anybody else, they would have. So they ignore him and treat him like garbage when it suits them, and then they use his work when it suits them.
Mm. Yeah, it almost seems intentional, doesn't it? Let's like rub him up the wrong way by using it. No, I don't know. Or maybe they just did it because it was the Eurovision's version of Father Ted, My Lovely Horse, which is a great song with it. My lovely horse.
The Graham Linehan, the Father Ted Eurovision episode is like a piece of art in comedy, I think. So, and everybody who's of a certain age or older will be familiar with it. So it's a funny thing to put in. It's just that
the timing.
You know, Graham Linehan has been treated really poorly by the mainstream media for the last few years, and ostracized very much for his views. And
he's lost everything. He lost everything. He lost his family. He lost his home. Sure, he's moved to America now because he felt that
views, which I consider were largely that he became a very strong defender of women like me who don't want men in women's changing rooms. And because of that, he's been ostracized. For them to use his work when it suits them is just a bit grim.
Well, yeah, but he's up there with, you know, J.K. Rowling and Sharon Davis, the Olympic swimmer. She's another one, you know, that kind of three of them have been very vocal in relation to that. And all three of them have been ostracized. It just goes to show how uncompassionate the left are, by the way, when they talk about the extreme right. They're the ones who are actually uncompassionate because they just don't accept anybody's views but their own. Really? Anyway, Leo Varadkar. Now, I'm going to have to read this one, okay? Because I want to get it right. So the former Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, surprised many people this week after writing about religion and faith in a Sunday Times opinion piece, where he warned about the growing influence of religious extremism and political leaders using religion to control people. But in the article, Varadkar spoke positively about the role of faith can play in society. Now, I'm not going to read the rest of it, but I spoke to Laura Perrins about this last week, and we were talking about the fact, and I asked her, if you don't have religion, are you kind of missing out on something? Like, and is society missing out on something? Like, was religion always the kind of gatekeeper of good morals in society? And if you don't have religion, like, are you just, like, rogue? Do you have religion?
Well, I think we do have religion. We replaced our religion with a new woke ideology, which is a form of religion. It's still got all the same stuff. It's still got people speaking from the pulpit. It's still got people who are cast out of society for saying the wrong thing. It's still got the angels and the demons. It's all got all the same stuff. So I think we haven't gotten rid of religion. We've just changed it into a new, you know, well, pardon the pun, we've put a lipstick and a wig and a dress on it. But
are we the sinners of this new religion then? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Yeah, we are. But I also just think that what bothers me about stuff like this is that everybody, even it's happening on immigration as well, that you'll have people starting to say things. Leo Varadkar's and people like Leo Varadkar would have sneered about Catholics a few years ago. It was fun and mainstream to make sneery comments about Catholic faith, about priests, about all that. And that would always happen on mainstream media and not about any other religion. And now I notice that it's starting to kind of come full circle where people are starting to say, oh, well, faith, I've seen a couple of articles, and I'm like, it was the same with immigration. Anyone who said anything was far right. Now there's kind of, well, we should have a conversation about immigration. Should we? So.
Do you believe in God, by the way? Sorry, sorry for interrupting you, but do you believe in God?
I do, but I think, like, I wouldn't be as faith-led as Laura. Like, Laura's...
No, well, of course, obviously not, but and Laura is a very special place for her. But, so what does he look like? I'm only asking, like, do you have a vision in your head of him? Like, has he got grey hair and is he sitting in the clouds? Or, it, like, I'm genuinely not being stupid. I'm just asking, like, do you have a vision in your head of who he is and what he is and what does he do, like?
No, not really. I don't really think about it like that. I think that there's a sort of a way to live your life that's in line with a certain set of principles, which for me...
But those principles were around long before. I mean, before Jesus came along and before the tablets, and it wasn't Moses, it was the other lad. It was the lad up on the mountain with the tablets, the commandments. Moses, wasn't it? You should know, you're the religious one, I'm not.
No, sorry. Moses. What?
No, Moses part, the tablets. Thou shalt not this and thou shalt not the other. Kill and rob your neighbor's wife and all that kind of stuff. It's Moses, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're making a show of us now. Like, is this a Bible study?
No, the point I'm making is, right, so he did this a couple of thousand years before Jesus, right? He stood up there with the tablets and God sent the lightning down and wrote on the tablets all the rules of life, right? But before that, I'm not saying people lived in a perfect society, but people knew that killing each other was wrong. They still did it, by the way. They were quite slightly barbaric. But they knew it was wrong. They knew that, you know, robbing your neighbor's missus was wrong, having an affair. Well, those things existed in society before all of that came along. So this idea, and the reason I'm saying that is that religion is some sort of guideline for life, suggests that you can't have good morals and good guidelines for life unless you have religion in it.
No, I don't think that's true. But I think that I think the human condition is that people do need, and that's my point about Ireland, you know, casting out the Catholic Church and saying, well, we're not having any of that, but then adopting this new religion with its own rights and wrongs and cultural and you know, blasphemies and all the things you can and can't say and what you get cast out for saying and doing. So I think like a lot of people need something. Mm. And where there is nothing, if they have no faith whatsoever, they find things to fill it. And sometimes those things can be really bad.
What is it, if it's not personal? Well, it is personal. So what do you get out of it? Like, is it just like every now and again you go, oh, Jesus, I hope to God this doesn't happen? I mean, like, I don't know. Is it like, do you get something out of it? When I was a kid, my mother used to make me kneel at the side of the bed before I went to bed every night. And I'd have to do this prayer. And it was, now I lay me down to sleep, I pray to God my soul to keep. And if by chance my something doesn't wake, I pray to God my soul to take, whatever it was. And then you were allowed to get into bed. But you had to say your prayers, kneel down at the bed and say your prayers. Like, so do you do things like that?
No.
I'm dumb. What are you asking?
That prayer. But I think that there's a comfort in a belief that there is something bigger and more important than you, for sure. And I think if you live your life in a way that there is some kind of, and like not a you know, heaven or hell thing, but that there is some sort of plan and consequences and you know, that you should try to be decent and be kind to all beings and all of that kind of stuff. I think I find that comforting, but you know what?
And does it work for you? I mean, are you decent and kind to everybody? Apart from the fact that when I text you, you don't always answer immediately. But are you decent and kind generally to everybody?
I pray the Lord your soul to take away, Niall.
Well, you know, I mean, it doesn't take a second just to respond, Sarah, when I send you a text or a WhatsApp message. You know what I mean? Because I can see you're online.
I'm one of those people that texts me at the worst moment.
So the question, back to the original question. The question was, are you a good person? Do you think you're a good person? Like, if you look back on your life, right? Let's say I was God at the pearly gates and I look back at Sarah's life. Like, do you think you're going down?
I think that I have made loads of mistakes like anybody else, but I don't think I've ever done anything fundamentally bad now.
So there might be a 3-day waiting period is what you're telling me before you're allowed in to reflect.
Might be some there might be a couple of protesters, couple of exes, couple of, you know, couple of placards. Might make me wait the 3 days, but I'll probably get in.
Speaking of the 3-day waiting period, by the way, of course, was a kind of landslide victory the other day in the Dáil, of course, when Holly Cairns, the Social Democrats bill, didn't pass through the bill where she wanted to get rid of the 3-day waiting period and decriminalise abortion. I'm assuming you were delighted by that, by the way.
Yeah, I think the 3-day waiting period is appropriate. Absolutely. Obviously, what I was surprised by was the how badly it lost.
That was because they had a free vote, which they should do more often, by the way. If they had a free vote on, you know, Micheál Martin's vote, I think he'd be gone by now.
But what does that tell you about the state of politics, Niall? That you have a free vote on something and that these are people who would have campaigned for repeal, who would have been actively involved. You know, they would have been told by Micheál in Fianna Fáil's case.
Get out there and canvass,
Yeah, but so when they have their own way, they vote against this.
We saw that in the last referendum where they wanted to remove women from the constitution and mother. And most politicians that they spoke to, even though they were out there canvassing on behalf of the party to tell everybody to vote yes in this kind of landslide no vote, all afterwards went with their tail between their legs and said, well, I knew it was going to be a no. I would have told people to vote no, but I was told by the party to tell everybody to vote yes. So they all knew. So the state of politics is bad.
Some of them admitted that they campaigned for yes and privately voted no.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time just thinking, God, like, that is, imagine all, I mean, you can talk all day about, you know, how crappy that is as a political situation that your politicians will be campaigning for one thing about it. But imagine what that does to you. You go out every day and you campaign for something and then secretly you vote against it. What a weird sort of existence to live, that you get told what to think and what to campaign for, but you privately vote against it because you know in your heart of hearts that it's nonsense. There must be a horrible way to live your life.
I couldn't do that, but I couldn't vote for something. No, I wouldn't be able to. I mean, I understand the whip system and how it works and why it works in parties sometimes. But I couldn't sell my soul for 50 shekels of silver or whatever it is. I couldn't just, like, if somebody, I was in a party and somebody said, I need you to vote tomorrow. We want the right, you know, for transgenders to get married or something. I don't know, whatever it is. Well, they can get married if they want. There's no problem getting married. But whatever, you don't, you understand what I'm saying? Some bizarre thing.
Yeah.
Or everybody must, you know, refer to them as a certain gender pronoun. And that's the law tomorrow where you'll be arrested. Like, and the party said, you have to vote yes for this. I said, see you so. I'm gone. I'd be out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whip system is needed. Otherwise, there's kind of chaos to a point. And I think that there's probably, I can understand that if you're a TD, there are some things you probably have to hold your nose on and go, okay, fine. But then there are certain ideological principles that you should have, like what is a woman, women in the Constitution, abortion, you know, like just certain things that I don't, I'm of the view that all these politicians who had journeys and stuff like that, I just don't trust it. I find it difficult to believe that somebody can change their ideological position so vastly from one end to the other that and believe that that's not politically motivated and self-serving.
Mm. No, I would agree. Just finally, I suppose, before we go, we've elections here, obviously. I don't know if you'd vote for any of them, to be honest with you personally. I'd love to see the monk getting elected just for the crack. I think that'd be funny. You know, it looks like, according to the polls, Janice Boylan is ahead in the polls at the moment, but Sinn Féin.
Yeah. I think that she might get pipped by the Social Democrat on transfers, though, because he's more transfer friendly than her. Mm. So in polling I saw today, she's ahead by, I think she's ahead by 5 or 3, but he catches her on transfers because he's got 5% more. He's getting 5% more transfers than her. I think the monk sort of had his moment, to be honest.
Do you think?
I don't see any momentum.
Well, he's third. He's third at the moment in the polls.
But I think if this was his first time, he could be first. I just think he sort of had a moment. I think he'll do well, but I don't think he'll, you know, feature.
He's funny, isn't he?
It is funny. And I watched a couple of his videos today, and they're kind of, you know, like he's kind of got that dry sort of, he's kind of sitting on a chair and he's knocked off and he kind of stands up and it's just all very like, we're knocking on these doors and, you know, it's just.
Yeah, if you don't want to vote for me, give me a number 2, give me a number 3, give me a number 4.
Yeah. Just, yeah. And that's the thing with him, that he is going to struggle a lot with transfers. Because, you know, if you think about the voter who's voting for him, they're voting for him or they're not voting for him. They're not giving him a 2 or a 3 in any great number. So that's where he'll struggle, I think.
Well, he might get some transfers from the likes of, say, Malachy Steensu, who is kind of, what, he's down at 7% according, I think it was 7% according to the poll. So he may get some transfers.
The other interesting thing about that poll is that the Fianna Fáil candidate is down at about 4%. 1% ahead of the People Before Profit candidate. I mean, you'd have to ask yourself whether or not the lads in Fianna Fáil will start to get very concerned if Fianna Fáil are getting, I understand that the worst by-election result ever for Fianna Fáil was the by-election in Dublin Bay South where Ivana Bacic got elected. And I think that result was 4%. You'd have to wonder whether the lads would start to make rumblings against Micheál. But as I've always said on the podcast, they talk a good game, but in the end they do nothing. So they probably
won't. But they're all pals of yours, in fairness. You know,
not all of them.
I mean, I
have a couple of pals.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, just before you go off there now, Jim O'Callaghan. We've spoken privately in relation to Jim O'Callaghan, and I always thought he was a good guy. I actually thought, you know, this guy could actually be a good leader for Fianna Fáil. He's lost popularity. In the last Ireland Thinks poll, his popularity dropped by over 30-something percent in the space of 2 or 3 weeks because of what he did during the farmer protest, or the fuel protest, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, this idea of bringing in the defence forces.
I think the army comment,
didn't do him any good, did it? And he's not. And I initially thought he's going to do well now in immigration. He really hasn't done anything. Really, he said a lot. It's like, you know, do you remember that the Cat in the Hat movie? And the kids run into the room and the cat's standing there and then the goldfish jumps out of the bowl and says hello. And the kids say to the cat, look at the goldfish, he's talking. And the cat says, he's talking. But is he really saying anything? And that's kind of like Jim. He's like the goldfish.
Well, I mean, to be fair, when he came out of the stock straight away, there was a lot of talk about, I mean, he was very much more proactive about deportations. There was, you know, there was movement there. What are you laughing at? Are you laughing at the cat in the hat?
No. I'm laughing at the fact over the last 10 minutes. It's getting darker in the room. It is. I mean, it'll get to the point shortly where we won't actually be able to make you out from the headboard.
I'll be
oh, look, the yeah, there you go. Yeah, sorry, Jim O'Connell, I interrupted you. I do apologise. Go on. No, I actually don't apologise. Go on.
I think that he started off really well. I think that, that comment about the army was a mistake. What I will say about that is that I don't believe for a second, and this isn't any insider intel, it's just my own view, is that I don't believe for a second that that Jim O'Callaghan, who is a senior counsel and a very clever guy, ever in a million years came out and said that comment about the army without Micheál Martin already knowing he was going to say it. It just doesn't work like that.
That sounds like that. Now, you just said without insider information, but that kind of sounded like insider information.
He went on the radio and said, it isn't. He went on the radio and said about the army coming in. Do you think he never spoke? You think that Jim O'Callaghan just decided off the top of his head and didn't speak to Helen McEntee about that?
Well, seemingly there was no communication between the two of them. Wasn't she giving out that he never told her about it? That he didn't inform her or something before he said it? I think she was whinging about that. I'm sure she is.
Probably. Anyway, the point is, I think that the army protest, the army comment was still ill-advised. I'm sure he regrets it because he got a lot of heat for it. I don't know. I think it's early doors. Let's see. But yeah, I mean, I think there's been a couple of gaffes. There's no doubt about that.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed, Sarah. It was worth picking the little puppy up out of the orphanage or whatever you want to call it, the home, you know. I'm glad you did. Well, I'm assuming that you enjoyed venting there and just getting a little bit off your chest.
I mean, I wasn't really prepared for questions about my faith, but, you know.
Yeah, well, that's okay. Yeah, and that's okay. And, you know, as soon as we finish now, I'm sure you're going to kneel down beside the bed there because I can see the headboard behind you. You're going to kneel down beside the bed. Right.
You're absolutely right. I'm going to pray to God to take your soul away tonight.
Yeah. And, well, maybe God will help you to answer your texts and WhatsApp a little bit quicker, a little bit smartly in the future, you know, particularly when they're, you know, friends.
I'm going to put a special tone on you. To get full attention.
Sarah Ryan, listen, thank you very much indeed, and I appreciate you coming on and talking to me. And it's been interesting, absolutely interesting. Thank you very much indeed.
Totally.
The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Podcast. Listen live on Facebook, YouTube, and all the usual live stream services. To get in touch, just WhatsApp or text 085-100-2255. The Niall Boylan Podcast. They told me to shut up. Available for download from all your usual platforms.